Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Would you consider yourself a naturally optimistic person?
I'm a pretty optimistic person.
I would definitely consider myself an optimist. Just to know that how many things need to go right for a human person to wake up, communicate, go through the day.
I'm very optimistic, yeah.
Not at all. Actually, no.
Are you feeling optimistic going into this new year at all?
I was. Everything was good until the past month. But then, you know, with COVID, that has been scary because I was supposed to go back home and I have been home for about 2 years now. Pakistan. It's just insane to not be able to see your family and just live an alone life.
Yeah, I'm hopeful in the new year.
Just like going through 2020, 2021, how bad the past 2 years have been relative to the rest of my life. I feel like this is just more of a reason to be extra optimistic for 2022.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright, and Happy New Year. I am so excited to begin the year in our show with the conversation we've got tonight. Lynn Nottage is the only woman to win 2 Pulitzer Prizes for playwriting, which is a sad fact, actually, but nonetheless, a statement about the way her work forces you to sit up and pay attention. She is as much a journalist as a playwright, chronicling the American experience and focusing her art on big, hard questions about opportunity and justice and human rights. And yet, her work is sneakily optimistic. This season, Lynn Nottage has 3 shows on stage. She wrote the book for the musical MJ about Michael Jackson. She's making an operatic version of her popular early show, Intimate Apparel. And her dark comedy, Clydes, is up at Second Stage now. The show's story turns around a group of people trying to find work and build lives after getting out of prison. And starting this week, Second Stage is selling virtual tickets. So for the final 2 weeks of the show's run, people don't have to come to Broadway to see it. They can buy tickets and stream it at home, which was a choice made even before the COVID surge that is now causing a lot of canceled performances across Broadway. I should say, I talked with Lynn just before this current surge. And we talked about the play, about her career exploring the emotional terrain of class and race, and about the deep lessons she found in a sandwich. Lynn, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You are, as near as I can tell, the busiest person in theater.
I am. That is not a lie.
So I'm really humbled that you have made this time for us. So I guess before the pandemic, you know, it was unheard of to offer streaming tickets to a Broadway show. Obviously, we all started doing unheard of things with screens in the course of the pandemic. But why continue it now? This makes you quite an outlier in the industry, right?
Well, I think that streaming really provided us with an exciting opportunity during COVID because so many of us were completely disconnected from our craft. I mean, theater is thought of as a live medium, bodies in the seat, an exchange of energy. And what streaming taught us is that there's still ways to be in dialogue that are exciting. And I think that once we got back in, we realized that there's so many people who don't have access to the theater. There are people who, you know, are immunocompromised, people who are older, people who are incarcerated, who want to come to the theater. And so I think this is a really marvelous opportunity to continue to reach audiences that we didn't have access to before.
I mean, it's one of a few ways you've leaned into changing theater and the way it does business in the course of the pandemic. You've been one of the more vocal artists in that regard, that, you know, we can't go back to normal when we get back. How do you think it's going?
I mean, yes, there's some ways in which we're back and it's status quo, but I do think that a lot of really exciting things that have happened that started during the pandemic, particularly since we were in the midst of this cultural reckoning, and it really forced the industry to begin to interrogate their practices. And some people really stepped up to the table and began shifting the way their theaters look. And some people, you know, as always, are resistant to change. And I can only speak anecdotally about the rooms that I'm in and the institutions that I'm interfacing with. And it feels as though they heard that they're really trying to figure out, how do we create a theater that is more inclusive, that is more welcoming, that really is reflective of the kinds of diversity that we have in our culture?
I mean, so that's an optimistic view. A refreshingly optimistic view. I mean, there's so much cynicism about change in general in so many spaces in our society.
Well, you know, I'm an optimist, Kai. I am someone that, in order to get up in the morning, I have to imagine that I'm going to be facing a day that was better than yesterday. Mm. And I think I bring some of that optimism with me into the rooms, into the rehearsal spaces that I go into. And just speaking about some of the rooms that I'm in, we've had people in diversity, folks who've done training, which has sunk in. And in one of the musical that I'm working on, it's probably one of the most beautiful companies that I've ever encountered. And it's a large company, and there's a lot of room for dissent and conflict. But because of the work that we've been doing, it really feels quite different than the space might have prior to the shutdown COVID.
The musical is MJ the Musical, and we'll return to that in some detail a little later on. But let's talk about Clyde's. Let's talk about the show itself. It's a dark comedy set entirely in the kitchen of a truck stop diner run by a tyrant of a woman who only hires people who've been incarcerated. And because they struggle to get hired with a record anywhere else, they are dependent upon her supposed generosity as she lords over them. And I guess, first off, Lynn, this is not exactly a welcoming Broadway setup to me, a comedy about formerly incarcerated people being abused. Why was this on your heart right now?
You know, I've been thinking about this play for a long time. We originally premiered it in Minneapolis before COVID. And it really comes about from the work and interviews that I was doing while I was researching my play, Sweat, in Reading, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. I came across so many people who were open and generous and who also happened to be formerly incarcerated. And I began listening to their stories, and many of them were incredibly heartbreaking. And I wanted to figure out, how can I tell this story about folks who are in limbo, in a liminal space, who really feel stuck and trapped, you know, because of their circumstances. Many of the folks that I interviewed had been out of prisons from anywhere from a week to a year. And they had one thing in common, is that they kept hitting up against a wall when they were looking for opportunity, whether it be housing or whether it be jobs or even whether it was reintegrating with their families. Is, you know, they hit that box that you have to check when you're going for employment that says, you know, you're incarcerated. And then it became this door that slammed in their faces. And I was really interested in, how do people who are in a liminal space really resurrect their lives? How do they get out? And I found this space, which was Clyde's, you know, a little box, which is a sandwich shop on this very nondescript stretch of road in Berks County, where I could grapple with some of these issues.
It often left me off kilter a bit, you know, because it's almost a screwball comedy at times, you know, I mean, just laugh out loud, funny, almost slapstick. But then also, as a viewer, you aren't sure whether you're supposed to be thinking something is funny sometimes, you know, like it's a little like, wait, maybe I shouldn't be laughing at this situation. And in some ways, that's a hallmark of your work, isn't it? I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, one of the things that I love about humor is that it is disarming. It's all of those things that you just said. But laughter also is this fantastic conduit, which you can filter through truth. I think that an audience, when they're laughing, in some ways, you know, they're more open. You know, the mouth is open, the body is open and relaxed. And I think that they're more ready and willing to engage with complicated ideas. And mm-hmm. so I really love using humor. And even in plays like Sweat and Ruin, which are considered to be tragedies, I think that it's humor is always threaded throughout it.
Yeah, yeah. I like that idea. Your mouth is literally open. You're laughing. You're ready to take things in. Well, you know, and there was a lovely profile of you, or I thought it was lovely, in T Magazine this fall. And the writer made an astute point in this regard that your work is always really accessible and familiar to audiences in form, but incredibly challenging in content. Do you agree with that?
You know, it's interesting because she asked me, do you agree with that? And I had to think for a second. I think, yeah, it is true. And I actually embrace that. I really, one of the things that I am super proud of is that my work really speaks to a cross-section of people that is accessible in ways that I feel some of my colleagues' work, which is brilliant and challenging and wonderful, but, you know, it's often geared toward one very small group within the audience. And what I feel I endeavor to do is to speak more broadly, you know, and I think it has a lot to do with the way in which I was brought up. I grew up in Brooklyn in a multicultural community. And so I was in dialogue with lots of people the moment I stepped outside of my door. And we were, you know, we were economically diverse and we were racially diverse. And so I thought of my audience, or I think of my audience, as those folks who still live on my block.
Yeah, wow. And I understand Second Stage is doing some things to, in terms of the audience, to make sure that this play then is accessible to both currently incarcerated and formerly incarcerated.
Yeah,
folks.
I mean, we
right?
have this wonderful partnership with Art for Justice, because one of the things that was really super important to me is that we reach the community that the play is directly about. You know, I didn't want it to feel sort of distant and remote. I wanted the folks who are actually going through some of the struggles that the folks on the stage are experiencing to be in the audience. And so we've been able to invite people in throughout the run of the show, and folks are really responding and feel that the work is actually quite truthful. Mm. And the play is definitely resonating with the formerly incarcerated. And one of the other things that we endeavor to do, because we have this opportunity to live stream, is to take it to the prisons.
Yes. Wow. I can imagine Broadway theater brought to a prison via live stream. That's a wonderful thing.
You know, I'm so excited. I mean, if we do anything throughout this run, that's one of the things I'm going to be most proud of, is being able to reach a new audience that's literally shut in.
Uzo Aduba is a revelation in this show in Clyde's to me.
She manages
to be almost a caricature of an abusive boss on one hand, while simultaneously lovable to the audience, and having a bit of mystery to her. It struck me that she's herself formerly incarcerated, but she's the only one whose backstory you don't fully tell. What were you up to with her?
You know, I really was thinking of the character is called Clyde, and she is seductively wicked, is how I like to think of her, is that we enjoy watching her be bad. And in some ways, she's the one character that doesn't change at all. She's the character who's completely intractable. And for those who are in that liminal space, she represents all of the obstacles that they're going to face when they get out. You know, and she's constantly tearing them down, and they have to figure out ways to resurrect their spirit. And so I was interested in her as the mischief maker, as Ilegua, as that person, you know, the gatekeeper.
But she's damaged herself.
She is very damaged herself, but she's the one character that's really not willing to do that kind of self-interrogation. And in some cases, it's the way in which she survives. I'm very interested in characters who are morally ambiguous. People who, on one hand, are doing something that is apparently generous. I mean, she is giving these folks opportunities where no one else will. But, you know, once they have that opportunity, she is cruel. Yeah. And she is exacting, and she is punishing. And I also think every one of us has had a boss at some point who has, in some form or another, tortured us. And so right. I think that Clyde is very relatable to a lot of people in the audience.
We got to talk about the sandwiches. The place is a sandwich shop, and the workers have this unreal reverence for making the perfect sandwich. And I don't really even have a smart question about it, Lynn. But what is with the adoration of sandwiches?
You know, I was trying to find the perfect metaphor for creativity, for how people reconstitute their lives. And the sandwich, I don't know why or how it came to me, but it's something that I love, and food is the one thing that we can all unite around, regardless of where we are. And I began thinking of the sandwich really as a way in which people can reinvent themselves. And, you know, the great thing about the sandwich, and I think it's something that is said in the play, is that it's one of the few things in which you can combine relatively ordinary ingredients and have this extraordinary culinary outcome.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in some ways, the metaphor worked for me too. I mean, the experience of watching the show, like I felt like I didn't really fully appreciate it until the last bite, you know, until it was, the sandwich was fully built, I suppose.
Oh, it's lovely. You know, and you think, you just think about savory and sweet and dissonant and harmonious, and that the sandwich really can be all of those things, is that you can have a grilled cheese sandwich and you can put some chutney on it and a slice of bacon, and suddenly you have like a small piece of heaven.
And, but ultimately, I kind of couldn't figure out whether it was a hopeful story or a dreadfully bleak one when I, at the end, and without giving away details, I wasn't sure where, I'm still not sure where I landed emotionally on that. What about you? I mean, is it a hopeful or a pessimistic story?
You know, I think it's open-ended. I really invite the audience to be the final collaborator and take away what they will. And there's some people who leave and see it as being incredibly healing and optimistic and hopeful. And there are other people who leave and think, oh my God, you know, the cycle is just going to continue.
Right, right.
And so I really think it's where one is in their life. Determines what ending they take away.
I suppose that says something about where I'm in my life.
You know, are you a glass half full or a glass half empty kind of person?
Coming up, Lynn is among the artists who have been credited with foreshadowing the Trump era. I'll ask her about the research she did for her Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Sweat. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. We'll be right back with more of my conversation with playwright Lynn Nottage. Hey, everybody. I just want to take a second to say thank you. You listening right now, and all of you who listen to us every single week, just thank you for spending time with us when, you know, let's be real, there is so much out there to deal with, so much out there to listen to in the world right now, and you choose to spend time with us. So thank you for that. And thanks not only for hanging out with us, but also talking to us. It's just, it's such a joy to hear from you, whether it's a voice memo, email, tweet, call on the live show, whatever it is. This is honestly and truly what makes the work worth it. Not just that I get to go meet smart people and bring them back to you, but also that you then get to feed back to me and tell us what's going on in your lives and from your corners of the world. Looking ahead, we're excited to start even more ways to be in conversation with you. So keep an eye out for that. And please, please, please do just keep sending us those messages. Until then, on behalf of everyone at the United States of Anxiety, thank you and Happy New Year. Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. And this week, I'm talking with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Lynn Nottage about her remarkable career and the multiple shows she has helped create for this season. Her current show, Clydes, was based on research she did in Reading, Pennsylvania, a Rust Belt town that has experienced a great deal of pain with the end of the manufacturing economy. That research also informed her earlier play, Sweat, for which she won one of her two Pulitzers. Sweat debuted in 2015 and made it to Broadway 2 years later. And by that point, the story felt prescient. you're thinking a lot about working people and the sort of cross currents of race and gender within this particular class of people, a group that has always been fetishized in all these weird ways in American politics. And, you know, I think it's rightly been said that Sweat sort of foreshadowed the Trump era in that regard. Was that on your mind when you wrote it?
Oh, I actually get asked that question a lot. You know, I could never have foreseen Trump coming. I don't think any of us in our wildest of imagination could have imagined that we would have had 4 years with Donald Trump as president. But what I did see when I was doing a lot of the interviews in the Rust Belt was the level of disaffection, particularly from sort of working class white people who felt like the American dream was slowly slipping between their fingers. And rather than sort of interrogating their own practices and thinking about how they were contributing to their own downfall, they were pointing fingers and beginning to blame others. And I thought that their kind of disaffection was beginning to metastasize and turn dark and ugly.
What was that owing to that you were observing in people? What how would you diagnose it?
You know, I can tell you very directly how I would diagnose it, is that one of the questions that I always asked when I was in Reading, Pennsylvania, is how would you describe your town now? And people would inevitably say, Reading was. And I thought, we have a really big problem because we have a group of people who can't imagine themselves in present tense and in future tense, is that they're always looking backwards. And there's a line in Sweat, which a character named Stan says, is nostalgia is a disease and it's slowly eating away at us. And I think that what I found is a lot of people were holding on to sort of American ideal that no longer existed or didn't ever really exist.
Lynn's new show, Clyde's, is a bit of a follow-up to this conversation she began out of her research in Reading, because one character, he's actually the only white character in the show, is someone who we first met on stage in Sweat.
They have one character named Jason who is the most unresolved character in Sweat when the play ended, and I felt like there were still things that I wanted to investigate with his character, and he somehow wandered into this particular play, and he stayed, and he is the outlier in Clyde's. I mean, he enters the play in the third scene, and he's somewhat of a disruptor. In Sweat, he commits a very heinous hate crime, and the question is whether someone who has done that can actually be forgiven. And I think that when he enters the sandwich shop, he enters with a great deal of shame. And I was just interested in how that moves through his body and whether someone like that really can find a new way through the world and be transformed. I mean, is he going to be able to get out of that space, or is he perpetually going to be trapped?
He was such a powerful character.
Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting to think about then, if you're saying that, you know, as you talk to people to develop Sweat, you heard all of this past tense, people who couldn't think of themselves in present tense. And then Clyde's is so about imagining a future.
Right. You know, I just felt, at least on a very personal level, after dwelling in the world of Sweat, which is kind of dark and it's not optimistic, that I personally needed to go someplace where I felt hope, where I felt that the characters who were experiencing real hardships had the opportunity to transcend and to forge community and to touch something that was beautiful. And in this case, it is a sandwich. And so for me, on a very personal level as an artist, I felt that I needed to share at least my hope and my optimism with audiences, and hope that in some ways they would respond to it and be in conversation with what I was writing.
Why this interest in class in this way? In this, you really, as an artist, are spending a lot of time in this space of where class and race and gender come together. Why is that something you're drawn to, you think?
You know, it's interesting because I recently had a revelation about this, because I was like, why am I so interested? Why do I constantly want to tell stories about working people? Number one, I'm a working person. I don't think that folks often think of artists as working people. And we're folks who have experienced a lot of economic hardship, and we work very hard for very little reward. And so there's a real connection between what we do as artists, craftspeople, and folks who are working in factories and working for a minimum wage. I mean, we understand that. So that's just the bottom line. But I recall when I was growing up, we had some hardship in my life, and our circumstances changed very, very quickly. And I watched my mother, who was this incredible woman, having to work like 24/7. You know, she'd get up at 6 a.m, she'd be out the door, and she didn't finish working until, you know, 9 and 10 o'clock at night. And that, as a child, really makes an imprint. And I think I wanted to tell her story and the story of, you know, my grandparents and the people who I encountered who were working people. And I thought, I don't see those stories that often. And I don't see the people like my family drawn in ways that are three-dimensional and compassionate.
You grew up in Borough Hill in Brooklyn. Yes. You said earlier that's where that family was. If I'm not mistaken, you attended the High School of Music and Art, right?
Yes, I did.
So a true New York local.
Yes.
What's your relationship to the city? True New York locals have quite a relationship to the history of this city. What about yourself?
You know, I love this city. You know, I feel sometimes like a small town girl because I haven't, for any length of time, lived anywhere else. I actually live in the house that I grew up in. And wow. I think that the city is just my lifeblood. I love the complexity of it. I love the diversity of it. I love that there are arts that are so accessible and that every single day I get on the subway, there's something that happens that kind of blows my mind.
Right. Do you remember when you first decided I want to turn to the arts? I have things to say that I can only say through art.
You know, I was really fortunate to have parents from the time I was very young who were deeply invested in the arts. You know, if you come to my home, there were always incredible works of art that were on the walls. And, you know, they took me to see the theater and they took me to see music. When I was very young, I just had this really delicious moment when I was watching Summer of Soul, that documentary that Questlove made. And in one of the first few frames, I saw my mother in the crowd enjoying music. And I thought, that's who she was. And that's
what
she
did. Wait, literally?
Like, literally.
Oh, wow.
It was really, really cool. And, you know, I haven't seen my mother in motion in 24 years. And so it was just like this Easter egg. It was this wonderful thing, but seeing her just reminded me of what they gave me. You talk about living in the city, and what they did is they gave me the city. And I grew up at a time when, as kids, we were like free-range chickens. You know, you opened up the doors and you just went outside, and you didn't come back in until the street lamps were on. And we explored, and thankfully, we weren't just playing out in the street, which is what we did, but we went to movie theaters and we went to the theater and we went and we heard music in the park. And it just, there was this kind of vibrancy that I wanted to keep alive for the rest of my life. And I think that's why I make art and that's why I make theater.
So you had that background. You went on and got, you know, degrees in Brown and Yale Drama School. But then you got a job at Amnesty International after school. And I wonder, was that just one of those out-of-school jobs? Or does that tell us something about the foundation of your work?
No, I think I got that job for very intentional reasons. When I was at the Yale School of Drama, it was during a very difficult moment in our country. It was the height of the AIDS epidemic. It was the height of the crack epidemic. I was watching classmates die, not only from AIDS, but from drug addiction. And suddenly the notion of writing a play felt very decadent to me. And I really thought, I have to do something. I have to be in conversation with this culture in some other way. And it was really a struggle for me to figure out how, as an artist, I could affect any kind of change. And so I deliberately looked for a job where I could do something that felt tangible. And so I began working at Amnesty International as the press officer during a key moment in like human rights history. And I look at those years that I was there as my second graduate school experience. And I was there when Nelson Mandela walked out of prison, which was an extraordinary moment. I was there when the Berlin Wall came down. I was there when the Guilford Four got out of prison. And so it felt as though human rights work was really doing. I mean, one of the things that we did when I was at Amnesty is really introduce the notion of human rights as the language of détente. Prior to that, when presidents and prime ministers sat down, human rights wasn't necessarily something that was placed on the table as an issue.
Yeah. I mean, certainly that background makes me think of your show Ruined, which you won your first Pulitzer Prize for in 2009. It's set in the Democratic Republic of Congo among a group of women who are trying to survive the ravages of war, including rape. So again, not exactly an easy setup for a night at the theater. But, you know, ultimately, I see it. Others have said it's a story of resilience. And I guess I just want to prompt you to talk about that, this idea of human resilience in your work and in that show in particular.
Well, 2004, 2005, when the war in Democratic Republic was raging, as we know, that war ended up taking like 6.5 million lives. It was the largest armed conflict since World War II. And yet it was not really registering with people outside of Africa. And so I went with the director, Kate Worski, and my husband to East Africa and began interviewing women who were fleeing that armed conflict. And one of the things that we found is that all of them had been raped and had been abused. And it was something that I wasn't necessarily reading in the newspapers. And I thought, this is a story that I want to tell. Originally, we had gone there to do a modern adaptation of Mother Courage, which is Bertolt Brecht's play. But when we began interviewing women, and hearing their stories, we realized that there was a story that was unique to Africa. But to answer your question, I would sit with some of these women and they tell me stories which were absolutely heartbreaking about what they went through. But what I really clung to was the way in which they were able to find hope and optimism and smile. And, you know, I saw embedded in their stories is the story, this incredible resilience. And one of the questions that I used to always ask them is, what do you think of when you think of the words mother courage? And they say, yes, mother courage. And they'd hold those words in their mouths and repeat them. And I thought, yes, that's the story I'm telling, is about mother courage, is about resilience. And I went home and I wrote Ruined. And I know a lot of the critics asked, why do I end the play, which is about something that's so dark, which is, you know, gender-specific human rights abuses, with optimism? I thought, because that's what I experienced, is that no matter what these women went through, they had mother courage, is that they were going to persevere and they were going to sort of resurrect their lives in beautiful ways.
It's so interesting because that was the truth, because optimism is actually the truth, which is so hard to wrap your head around in today's world.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think of just the experiences of us as Black folks in America over the last 400 years. And what we have is this incredible ability to reach for optimism. And we're incredibly resilient. And I think that's not recognized enough.
It's really not. I often say, you know, I mean, easily the most optimistic, forward-looking, progressive people in this country are Black people and immigrants. You know, for all the talk about we're supposed to be victims, we are easily the biggest believers in a better future.
Amen to that. It's so true.
I'm Kai Wright. I'm talking with playwright Lynn Nottage about her remarkable career. Coming up, I ask Lynn about the space Black artists, and Black women in particular, are making for themselves in the world of commercial theater. Stay with us.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This Broadway season opened with an unprecedented number of shows by Black writers and directors. Shows spanning everything from experimental dramas to feel-good comedies. And the trend went beyond Broadway. The Metropolitan Opera mounted its first ever show written by a Black composer. So in the world of commercial theater, it's been a banner season. But before this season began, Lynn Nottage had been one of the most vocal artists demanding just this kind of change. So I was curious what she thinks about the progress. We began our conversation talking about your role as a change agent in the theater world, and I want to come back to that. This season, Broadway returned with all of these shows by Black artists, and it's sort of the latest space to get a pat on the back for taking Black people seriously as human beings, you know, but let alone as leaders and artists. How do you feel about it? Do you feel like, oh yeah, this has been a real advancement this season?
Well, number one, I have to say, it is a remarkable moment, and I hold on to this moment because I share it with artists who I respect, you know, particularly young artists who I think are incredible storytellers. And I think it's so easy for us to dismiss this moment as being a blip. But these are people who are making art on the highest level, and they belong on Broadway. And I'm really excited, no matter how we've gotten there, that we're there. And hopefully, audiences will continue to come and support our work. It really is about whether we can build audiences and demonstrate, you know, commercially that there's people who want to support our storytelling. It's, you know, Broadway is very different than the not-for-profit world.
Right, right. It's a lot of money to put up a show, and you got to make money.
Yeah, Broadway, unfortunately, is about the bottom line. But now, 2-3 months into the Broadway season, our shows are selling and people are coming to them and they're loving them. And what we're demonstrating is that there is room for a diversity of Black voices, because every show is very, very different, and that we're not a monolith, and that we really not only deserve to be here, but we're enjoying being here. Right. And so it's going to be really difficult to kick us out.
Right.
You know, it's not, I've gotten
shouldn't have let
us
in if you didn't want us to stay, because we're not going no place.
Yep.
I mean, do you think audiences are changing, or gatekeepers are changing, or both, or is that the wrong way to think about it?
Well, I think that gatekeepers are certainly changing. I can tell you for Clyde's at Second Stage that Hadi Kamara, who is now the executive manager, I believe, or executive director of Second Stage, is an African-born woman. Mm. And she's come in with a lot of big plans, so that theater is not going to be going backwards, because it has a real shift in its leadership. And so that's super exciting. I know on MJ, that our producer, who's Leah Volek, it was really important for her to bring Black folks onto the producing team who are being trained, and they're the next generation of folks who are going to be producing on Broadway. So I do feel that there are real tangible things that are happening that are going to be exciting. And we may not feel the reverberations of that this year, but, you know, in 2 and 3 years, I think we will.
Yeah. The conversation makes me think a bit about your show, Meet Vera Stark, which is one I actually haven't seen, sadly, but I heard you talking about it with my colleague Allison Stewart on WNYC's show All of It. And you were talking about the ways that the archetypes of Black women on stage have changed over the years. You know, there's the audience, there's the gatekeepers, but then there's the actual presentation of Black people on the stage. And so I'm curious, what is that change you've seen over the years in terms of how the way Black women in particular are presented has shifted?
Number one, I think there's a diversity of Black women who are having the opportunity to put their truths on the stage, and that ultimately is going to change who we see and sort of the manifestations of Blackness that are presented on the stage. So I think that that's a huge shift. You know, you think about the artists who are storytellers like Dominique Morso and Katori Hall and Susan Laurie Parks and, you know, younger writers like Antoinette Nwando and Jocelyn Bio. I mean, the fact that I could continue to go on for another 10 minutes means that we're all bringing our truths to the stage in very different ways. And so that is a big shift. But I do recall, like many years ago, speaking with a dramaturg at a regional theater, and specifically it was about Ruined, which is, as we spoke before, set in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and having the dramaturg say, this is great, but our audiences really need a character that they can connect with. And I thought, excuse me. And, you know, it took me aback because I thought, are you telling me that your audience, and what she was really saying is that her white audience couldn't connect with my Black characters, and in particular, my Black women characters.
Are your Black woman self.
And my Black woman self. And I thought, no, I am not going to make this easier for you because this is my truth. And it's time for you sort of sit back and hear it for a moment and figure out how you can join me rather than me constantly having to join you.
Well, it makes me think, because I'm thinking about your optimism, and it makes me think about the show Intimate Apparel, which I also haven't seen, but I cannot wait to get to see the operatic version of it. But, you know, it's now, as I understand, one of the most produced plays in American theater. And, you know, this show by a Black woman has certainly forced a whole lot of people well beyond Broadway to relate to a Black experience.
Well, hopefully. I mean, I wrote Intimate Apparel after my mom died. And I wanted to write something that if she were going to a theater with a group of her girlfriends, that she would really enjoy. And I put my heart and soul into the play. And I think that audiences recognize that truth. And that's why it's been so popular. And, you know, and it centers this character named Esther, who is a seamstress in the turn of the century in 1904 America, who is trying to figure out who she is in a world that has rendered her invisible. And I think that it's a struggle that I've had as an artist. And so I think that in part, I was telling not only Esther's story and my mother's story, but my own story.
Mm. I read somewhere that you were inspired by a photo of your grandmother or great-grandmother maybe working as a seamstress in New York.
Yeah, my great-grandmother came to New York at the turn of the century, in this case from Barbados. And she was one of eight sisters, and she came at 18, not really knowing anyone. She worked as a seamstress. And over the course of, you know, the next 20 years, she was able, one by one, to bring all of her sisters to the U.S., which I find to be incredibly remarkable, that she just had the tenaciousness and the wherewithal to transform her entire family. But what you were mentioning is that when my grandmother was moving out of her home, I literally found, stuck in a Family Circle magazine, a photograph of her and my great-grandmother. And it's the very first time I'd ever seen that woman. And I realized that there were all these stories that my family had never shared with me. And because they didn't either deem them important enough to share, or, you know, they didn't think about legacy and preserving our own personal archive. And so I went about trying to piece together the life of my great-grandmother in New York City in the turn of century, and that became Intimate Apparel. In some ways, it was me really trying to navigate my own ancestry and fill in some of the blanks that existed there.
Well, and I, you know, like I said, I bring the show up because it has become such a staple of American theater. And I just wonder what you take from that as someone who has been told in the past, your work isn't relatable, you need to adapt it.
Well, number one, I reject that notion because clearly the proof is in the pudding with Intimate Apparel. But I think that audiences ultimately respond to truth, you know, regardless of who's telling that story. I think that we have the expansiveness to be able to invite in a multitude of perspectives. And I think that one of the things that has been an obstacle is the gatekeepers, is that their belief that audiences won't respond. And I reject that notion. Mm. And the more and more stories that are out there, I mean, you just look at television, the way it's been diversified in film, it's been diversified, that there are audiences for all kinds of storytelling.
You are a prolific writer, as anyone listening to this conversation will gather. We could go on and on and on about all the shows you've written. And you have yet another show out this season. You wrote the book for the musical MJ about Michael Jackson, which I have to assume is a tricky project, to say the least. I mean, you know, this is a jukebox musical, which is to say it's supposed to be a feel-good thing about a beloved star. It necessarily deals with the world of child abuse that has come to define Michael's life, too. Why did you take this on?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Someone asked me that question the other night, and I realized that I have been working on trying to tell the story of Michael Jackson since 2013, which is when I first began sort of drafting an outline for a musical, not this particular musical, but something prior to that. And I think, in part, I've been drawn to Michael in part because of his complexities. And one of the phrases that I cling to is, you must sustain the complexities, but also because my life so thoroughly tracks with him. His music is the soundtrack of my life. You know, the very first album that I owned was ABC. You know, my favorite album when I was in high school was Off the Wall. Mm-hmm. And I played that album until literally I couldn't play it anymore because there were so many scratches and grooves in it that every other song would pop and stop or repeat.
Because you've been doing too much jumping around.
Jumping around, And then, you know, when I got to college, it was Thriller. And we'd have Thriller dance parties. And so just embedded in my creative DNA is Michael Jackson and his music. And that is not easy to let go. And I think that I really wanted to create something, a musical that allows people who have this love for Michael Jackson to really process that and understand who he was as an artist.
Well, and he's such a part of the Black story. I mean, you know, anybody of either of our generations, you know, he was just an icon of Black success and Black art and Black joy. And so it is a hard thing to process for us to now be at this stage in his story.
Yeah, exactly. And Michael Jackson also gave many of us permission to create in different ways. I mean, he was in, now, you know, we think of him as a king of pop, but he was a rule breaker.
Yeah.
As an artist. And he redefined, you know, the notion of what Black music could be. And I think that conversation is an important one.
Yeah. You're certainly one of the most successful playwrights in theater, perhaps the history of theater. And yet you told the Times you don't want to be known as a playwright, which I guess maybe it's or only as a playwright.
Okay, I was like, I do want to be known as a playwright.
Okay, that it was that wasn't enough for you, that you don't want to be pigeonholed to that. And maybe this is a reflection of my limitations and the limits of my own ambitions, but it is difficult for me to wrap my mind around the idea that your ambitions stretch beyond playwriting.
Yeah, you know, I'm really interested in different ways in which we can tell stories. And I think that a lot of times the proscenium is really limiting and doesn't necessarily allow for the complexities and the diverse ways in which we want to bring our characters to life. And so I'm always trying to reach for new ways to reach audiences because a lot of times theater is prohibitively expensive. Mm-hmm. And it takes real effort for someone to go online, you know, buy that ticket and then, you know, get in their car and come into town. But I thought, well, there must be other ways to bring theater more easily to folks in their communities. You know, streaming is one way, but also I'm very interested in sort of multimedia and meeting the folks where they are. And, you know, how can we create theater in laundromats and in parking lots and in spaces that people are so used to going to, they don't even realize that they're engaging with art or colliding with art. And so that's what I think I was talking about.
Mm-hmm. What's on your heart for the future? I dare I ask, not to reveal anything you're working on, but just what do you know? If you have so much of your art, you're chronicling the American experience. You know, what are you thinking about? What do you feel like needs to be chronicled?
You know, I think that I'm going to actually move smaller and tell more personal stories because I feel that I've spent a lot of time looking outward. And this is a moment that I think has come about because of COVID and having more time for self-reflection, is that I want to tell the story of my family. Mm. I want to tell stories of my friend group and stay a little closer to home. Wow. And so that's what I think, you know, it's like not reaching as far, but reaching deeper.
And you think that's because of the experience of COVID for you?
I do think it's because of the experience of COVID. I, for the first time, spent a lot of time meditating and still, because I'm not used to someone who's being still. It's like I'm a workaholic. I work 24/7. But what COVID did for the first time was allow me to sit and think. And I suddenly had room for a lot of thoughts and emotions that had always been there, but because there was so much noise, I wasn't really able to access them. Mm-hmm. And so I want to sort of explore that more deeply.
Well, we will all quite look forward to what comes from that stillness and silence for you. Thank you so much, not only for this time, but just for all your work and your contribution to theater.
Well, thank you so much, Kai. I listen to your show, and I really love your show, and I'm super, super delighted to be here with you.
This is the United States of Anxiety. If you missed something tonight, or you just want to catch up on previous shows, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, or you can go to wnyc.org/anxiety for our full archive. And if anything Lynn Nottage said made you just want to stand up and shout, do it into your phone, record it as a voice memo, and send it to me. Really, we love to hear from you, even on the weeks we don't take your calls live. So send me a voice memo with any thoughts the show sparked for you at anxiety@wnyc.org. And since Lynn has us thinking about working people, a reminder that a lot of people's work goes into this show each week. So to name a few, Kevin Bristow and Milton Ruiz work the soundboard for the live show. Jared Paul mixes and sound designs our podcast version. Hannes Brown wrote our catchy theme song, and it's performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Regina Dahir is the producer you hear asking people questions at the top of the show every week, and if you've been booked as a guest here, you've certainly talked to her. Kusha Navidar is our digital mastermind and honestly the one going through all those voice memos you sent. So thanks, Kusha. And Karen Frohman helped me create the show in the first place and is our careful editor each week. Me, you know, I'm Kai Wright. You can catch me on Twitter @Kai_Wright, and I'll talk to you here next Sunday. Thanks for spending time tonight.